activities that you need to keep up to date with. So do not forget, each and every Tuesday for the month of February, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM.
You're listening to CKUT. The following is a previously broadcast program. Stay tuned. You messing with guys and you messing with me. Good evening. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio. From drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between, professional student and community productions in and around Montreal, the island also known as Jojage in the Ganyagaha language, and Muniang in Anishinaabemowin, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end in both English and in French. I'm your host, Sarah Day, live in studio on Thursday, February the 15th, 2024. Happy post-Valentine's Day, post-Galentine's Day, Ash Wednesday. Did you have a great Mardi Gras? What a week of celebration and a week to be enjoying theater and arts in the city as well. A big meld to the cast and crew of The Flood, Imago Theater, opening that production over at Centaur Theater, running until later this February. We are also going to take a look at two remounts over at Mainline Theater that are going to be electrifying the space this weekend. Before the end of the hour, we will take a look at the remounts of Johnny Legdick, the rock opera musical that has been rocking Montreal for a decade now, hard to believe, and also a guest who recounts eight near misses, attempts on his life, or times where his life came to a very screeching halt. It's a storyteller extraordinaire who's going to tell his story, Nine Lives and Eight Near Misses. If you missed it at the Fringe, this is your chance to check it out. That conversation with those two performers coming at 6:30. Then before that, we will be chatting with dancer, creator, Nate Yaffe. Their show, Because of the Mud, is at La Chapelle next weekend. We will talk to Nate about this show, which involves, as its cast, two rocks and four aspen trees that all share the same name. I was sufficiently intrigued by that description. We'll find out more at 6:15. But up first, a fascinating new show that meditates on immigration and translation. It comes to you at the Mai by two performers who were paired to do some development work a little bit before the pandemic, but when things kind of hit in 2020, they were forced to work remotely. Their names are Naishi Wang and Jean Abreu. Jean is originally from Brazil, has trained and lived much of his life in London, I believe, and has since become a movement director for different magazines, which is fascinating work, as well as forming his own school of movement. As well, Naishi is someone who grew up in Changchun, China, my apologies, and eventually came to further his studies in Canada, is now partly based in Montreal, I believe, we'll find out a little bit more, and has been enriching his practice ever since. Their fascinating dance show pair talks about connection, as I mentioned, immigration and translation. And in fact, when you walk into the space, you see the two of them already on stage with a very, very long, I think I want to say around 20 foot long, 30 foot long piece of clear material or paper that is covered in different pieces of writing material, and they're actually sketching and drawing on it. And what they end up doing with that is a very interesting feast for the ears, let's just say, before moving into more dance oriented work. Joining us on the line right now is Naishi and Jean, who are going to be getting ready to perform this evening at the Mai. Welcome to Upstage.
Hello, Sarah. Hi. Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Hello,
so much.
Sarah. Jean here. Hello. Thank you for having us.
Hello, Jean. So this is the third stop on your Canadian tour. You performed earlier this year in Vancouver at the Push Festival. You just did a couple of dates in Toronto. Tonight is the second of four shows here in Montreal. I was at opening last night. How did you find the audience response?
Very nice. Very welcoming audience. Thank you so much for that.
Yeah, it was my first time performing in Montreal, and super excited. And yeah, the audience was very warm. Valentine style.
Yeah, it was a wonderful Valentine's Day show. I did bring my date last night to enjoy the performance. So this is a piece that I think on the face of it, if you don't know too much about dance, it just really looks like something very contemporary, very modern. You're both outfitted very comfortably. Jean, you're wearing, I think, like a lavender sweater, maybe sweatpants. You looked very cozy as well, Naishi. But you're both referencing dance styles from the places where you grew up, where you came from, that there might be a little bit more layers there than we might suspect. Could we start there? Tell us about what elements you might have incorporated from some of your background. Naishi, there's elements of Chinese folk dance in this.
Speaking of Chinese folk dance, I think like I embody the Chinese folk dance in a deconstructed way. And, you know, the Chinese folk dance become something else when the immigrant experience happens to be. So my always practice was also like, how can I maintain the original form in a really translated way since I moved to Canada? So I fusioned with contemporary dance and conceptual dance from very somatic perspective. So the so-called Chinese folk dance form is like lived in my body, and of course I try so hard to not only hiding it but showcase the essence of it, but with very formally deconstructed way, if this is I don't know if you understand this.
Yeah, I mean, for us also this investigation of the migrant experience was a lot about us returning and attempting to return to these origins to a certain extent. But in many ways is, as Naishi mentioned, deconstructed. And there is no way that there's a sense of purity any longer, because our histories of over 20 years growing up or developing as artists in our chosen home countries, in my case, is in UK. But in my sense, like a Brazilian culture in terms of dance, it you know, everything is present in every sphere of the culture. So I think it's very much part of the body, and it's no longer something that I can get rid of. And what is interesting in this journey is to see what happened when we arrived to the chosen places where this original material, where did it go? Well, what translation became to be now?
You both ended up leaving where you grew up to go somewhere else to pursue your dance. You had opportunities to study and to perform. As you mentioned, Jean, you went from Brazil to London, and for Naishi, you came to Canada from China. What was that part of that experience that made you want to share part of that story with audiences? Why is that a part of your work as an artist? Naishi, can you start with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the piece hold on to our individual journey, that we find the similarities because we pursued training in dance. That's the reason why that we choose to migrate from our home country to our adopted country. From that experience, we lived in a bodily perspective, and then we sense from the body, we translate from body, we dance from the body, and we observe things with the body. Of course, the body have certain understanding, but mostly the cultural differences is mixed with misunderstanding. So the reason why for us to collaborate with each other, we wanted to really translate this misunderstanding versus understanding. And with our unified theme, finding our own different experiences through this immigrant journey.
Jean, what particular part of the immigration journey did you want to tell in this particular performance?
As I said, like our experiences, you know, what we found was very, very similar. One of the first things we realized that we had this shared migrant transitional life. And one of the things that it was very clear when I first arrived in the UK is that I had an experience of the whole world very sonically. I had very little English. So everything got amplified, and I started notice, you know, minute movement, and though the language was not very, very clear to me, but I had to sit inside of this misunderstanding, but at the same time paying attention to how much I could understand by the bodily language. So this became very central to our investigation, how we wanted to proceed with the ciphers. In my case, we have different answers, different journeys. For me, it's the kind of distance, I suppose, that I feel very attached to at the moment for the work.
That is the voice of Jean Abreu, who is the co-creator and performer of Deciphers on at the MAI this week, also joined by Naishi Wang, his co-creator and fellow contemporary dance artist. I tried to set the scene a bit at the beginning of the show when we're looking at, what is that, 20 feet long piece that has different printouts and what looks like covers of newspapers and writing on it before you kind of do something very transformative with it. That's a direct reference to your collaboration at the start of the process. Hard to believe the pandemic started several years ago, but you know, people are still performing and working on art that the seeds were planted way back when. So how did you as dancers start working on this piece when you were in lockdown?
Well, as we mentioned, we met like kind of by a common friend, and immediately we really felt that we had something to be in the studio together. But of course, pandemic came and it totally derailed our plans. We had to exchange. We resulted to meet weekly or every 2 weeks, writing letters, virtual letters to each other, and kind of trying to kind of translate what our ideas, who we were, towards each other in order to sort of create the kind of raw material, because there was no any other way for us to be in the same space, physical space. Fast forward, we then eventually were able to be on the same stage, but we really knew that what we wanted is to be in the studio at the same point in time physically.
And how? At what point in your process did you finally get to meet? Well, start working in person.
We got offered for a visiting dance artist at NAC. It was 2021 November. We had spent 5 weeks in person together. It was like the magical 5 weeks where the pandemic limitations were lifted. Jean was able to travel from UK to Canada. And it was the first time we don't have other things because we can only focusing on Deciphers. That was the magical 5 weeks that inspired us to make materials, brainstorming about ideas. It was really great.
So what is it about your work together that you think is appealing to audiences? What is it about your partnership or your chemistry so far that you think makes your work stand out? Jean, do you want to answer that?
I think it's the bodily narrative of these two immigrants coming together to really share their similar but at the same time very unique journeys. I think that's one of the most powerful things at least I speak from a personal level, and the attraction that when I began this process is still the same, is how can we exist in the same space, understanding but not understanding our similar journeys? And I think that's one of the points for me that is very powerful.
Naishi?
I think from the dance perspective, we try to make a new... I don't think this fits as a contemporary work, but I feel like this fits as like a new concept and a new element that is based on the performing art. In terms of our the core of the piece, I think it's like, you know, the two migrant experiences from very like different journey, and I feel this is like the talk about the really the insecurity of the immigrants that they try so hard to live in the adopted country, and to question the reflection of the piece is our inner world, and this world is constantly bringing us the question, are we enough? I think whoever is witnessing this, we invite them to create their own experience, not only from the immigrant journey, also from this like insecurity that someone may face at the moment.
I know it's hard to predict the future, but both of you are in-demand artists who are working all over the place. Do you think you'll ever, I don't know, I don't want to say the word like shed that immigrant status, but do you ever see yourself moving away from this need to explore the immigrant experience in your work? Will it ever stop being something that is at the forefront for you? Jean, do you want to take that?
I think in the ciphers, what it's very interesting is that, you know, we utilize the immigrant experiences as, and our experiences as a platform. I think in my personal case, we forget that human beings are transient beings. We all move from being a child to be an adult. This is a transition to being, you know, a son to be a father, or transition from, you know, from your school to another school. So this sentiment of disconnectedness and trying to be somewhere else is present everywhere, in everything that we do. So for me, my migrant experiences, it's something that it's a source, but not as like specifically just that, but actually it's like it just opened my eyes to attain to a much broader kind of universal ubiquitous thing. So I think it will be with me for however long. I can't distance myself anymore.
That's really, really well put. Naishi, did you have any thoughts on that question?
I also have other interests. Yes, I also wanted to like, you know, explore other things. I myself, I do like Chinese calligraphy and drawings. That's also my part of my practice. And besides this immigrant experience, I feel this is something that I cannot forget, and it will live it forever with me. I breathe. Feels like, okay, I breathe like this heart of, you know, this in between. I'm half Chinese, I'm half Canadian. Even though if I'm going back to China, I have the same thing that I feel, okay, this I'm not really 100% Chinese because I've lived in Canada for 20 years. I adopted the culture differences. And it was hard for me to be even in China and talking with my parents. And it's the same thing. Like when I come back, I have also this loneliness. I feel like, you know, that, I just feel like, okay, this is like, you know, one of the things that either I have to embrace it or like forget about it. When something that you forget about it, it's not really like you forget about it. It was like still living in your body. And something, of course, when you talk about, you know, making work, making a deep work, the layer of the immigrant experience heightened in my body awakes when we talk about something so deep. Of course, that when I make a next work or the future work, the layer of that shows up.
Very well said. I think it speaks to the flexibility of your work as artists, that this is a main thing that you do want to explore, but you, of course, have other interests and other things coming in the pipeline. And you did mention, Naishi, some of your calligraphy work there, which is an element in the show itself. So we'll leave you on that note. You've got a curtain in just over an hour from now. Naishi and Jean, thank you so much for taking the time to come on Upstage.
Thank you so much, Sarah. It was great talking to you.
Great. Thank you so much.
That was the wonderful Naishi Wang, as well as Jean Abreu, who are co-creators and co-dancers in a show on Now at the Maya. There is a performance tonight, and then two after that, so the 16th and the 17th. And you can check that out at the Maya website. Head to m-a-i.qc.ca. The box office is also there as well. And you can call 514-982-3386. Tickets are $28. So two more performances after this evening. And after that, they're headed on to a fourth and final tour stop. So they've done Vancouver, Toronto, Montreal now, and then Ottawa, which is really cool. So Naishi Wang and Jean Abreu, who are performing Deciphers. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM. The time is 6:19. We're going to have a conversation here with another kind kind of dance interdisciplinary show. We'll speak with co-creator Nate Yaffe of Because of the Mud. It's on at La Chapelle next week. And then afterwards, stay tuned to Remounts over at Mainline Theatre, electrifying audiences this weekend and next. We'll learn more about Johnny Legdick as well as Nine Lives. Stay tuned. CKUT time is 6:22. Welcome back to Upstage, the show about theater on the radio. My name is Sarah Day. I'm your host this evening. I'm here joined by Xander, as well as two guests we're going to have coming on in just a couple minutes to talk about remounting their shows at Mainline Theater this weekend. But first, I want to take you to La Chapelle Scène Contemporaine, where next week we open a new show called Because of the Mud. It's presented by Le Radeau. It's a co-creation by Nate Yaffe and Corinne Donnelly. A story of family and queer identity is told by a grove of four aspens who all share the same name, Roberta, and two stones. I'm interested to know about the construction of the piece and some of the themes behind it. Joining us on the line is co-creator Nate Yaffe. Welcome to Upstage.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, thanks for being here. This is what first grabbed me when I got the press release about the show. Four aspens in a grove are all named Roberta. And I was like, I don't even know if I need to know much more about this show. I'm intrigued right off the bat because this is kind of, I'm entering an absurd world here. Tell me about the construction of this story of Because of the Mud. Then maybe we can get into some of the technical aspects. It is a show that uses theater, dance, and music. But I want to start with the story, if that's okay with you, Nate. Please go ahead.
Yeah, sure. It started a while ago. My friend Corinne is an experimental playwright based out of New York, and they were interested in using dance as a way to embody non-human characters because they pretty much exclusively write for non-human characters and weren't so satisfied with the way that directors have mounted their plays. And through many years of conversation, I was like, yeah, I think there's something in my improvised dance practice, my use of imagination, somatic imagination, which is a tool to try to grapple with things that are hard to wrap your mind around, and using the body instead as a way to connect with these
certain other perspectives. So we decided to embark on this together. It's the first play I've ever directed. I'm usually a choreographer, but I've acted in plays, and this time I'm having a lot of fun telling the story both through words and through movement and through set design and through music. Yeah.
Did it take a good talking to or a boost of confidence to further immerse yourself in the world of theater? Because your background is mostly in dance and also in video. You mentioned you have performed, but to take on a more directorial kind of viewpoint.
Yeah. A boost of confidence. Well, it was a shift of perspective because they were like, well, you know, the story needs to be told the way it needs to be told. And I was like, it will. And I was imagining really approaching it the way I would approach dance, but like letting the body speak first. But in fact, you know, in really delving into the text, I was like, oh no, there's so much nuance in these characters that needs to really take the spotlight. I ended up using the body as a way to have a subtext to the play, to bring out things that the words can't say. Because the crux of this whole story is how to attempt to have empathy with organisms, with beings, with earthly beings that we can't really imagine their lived experience. For example, the characters in this play are living the climate crisis in a way that only trees and rocks can. And so the written word is very anthropomorphized. You know, they're giving English words with French subtitles, but English words to four aspens and a granite rock and a quartzite rock, and they all have different experiences from each other. But how to make it not just seem like a bunch of humans on stage, that's where the body comes in, that's where the costumes come in, to kind of shift the logic of how they interrelate on stage, how they feel the story, really was the choreographic angle. So that was something that happened with my over time in rehearsal with my beautiful collaborators, where I really was kind of dislodged myself, knocked off center from how I usually work. And we all had to adapt to meet the imagining of this play, the needs of this play, because we all come from different backgrounds. There's clown, music, you know, experimental cabaret, community theater. All the artists on stage come from different backgrounds. So it's been a big exercise also of meeting each other, meeting the characters of the story. And this beautiful message is really all about attempting empathy, and that there's a value in this attempt.
Why do you think it's important now to focus on empathy and exercising that muscle?
Oh my God, like right now?
Yeah.
I think it's like, you know, there's a lot going on in the world right now, and we talk about that every day in rehearsal, crises on many fronts. And I believe in welcoming that into the art process on stage. I grew up in dance where, classical dance, where they would say, leave your baggage at the door. But no, I believe in understanding that, you know, we are telling a story and we are imagining the construction of this, this piece. You know, we're entering into this universe, but this universe, this imagined universe exists in the real world, and we are real people on stage. And that part, like those feelings of how we feel every day, are welcome on stage. So for me, the attempting empathy is really a first step, like, to engaging with a myriad of conflicts. And you don't have to succeed. I guess what I'm learning and what I believe in the stories is, like, it's not about necessarily succeeding. Like, the attempt already is a lot. So just trying to imagine what it's like to be a tree, even though we know we'll never succeed, already has a lot of richness and utility and like usefulness. And in the story, you know, the trees try to empathize with rocks and vice versa. And so we're a bunch of humans trying to imagine how other organisms imagine empathy with other organisms. So anyway, I feel that, you know, I'm not going to really solve any global crisis like the one in the story, but all I can do is this first step, which is just try to imagine how other beings live and or experience their lives. And then that's a first step to kind of changing a worldview where, you know, I'm not the center of it. And if everyone kind of embarks on that, then maybe that'll, I don't know. I'm not going to say anything too grandiose.
No, what you said is just great. That is the voice of Nate Yaffe, who is the director and choreographer of Because of the Mud. It's a new piece that works off of text by Corinne Donley, who's based in New York. And the reason we're talking about trees and minerals and rocks is because the performers are incarnating these roles in nature. And this is maybe a silly question, Nate, but I was just wondering why Corinne and you have made this choice to depict trees and rocks as opposed to like animals, let's say, to convey this kind of like concern for the environment and the risks of climate change.
Yeah, well, Corinne can speak to that. Well, they're not here right now, but Corinne is a playwright and wrote this entirely before approaching me. And they were inspired by living in the Western United States, where there are a lot of aspen forests. And aspens, especially out there, I think, but all aspens are a type of tree that grow, can spread through their root system, meaning they grow new trunks from their roots. So they literally are, they're clones. They're the same DNA, and they're very connected. And sometimes entire forests for acres, hundreds of acres, are one tree. And they were just, you know, faced with that, imagining, wow, what does that feel like, you know? And what is their experience? You know, they're going underwater stress in the West, and what is their experience, their lived experience as a tree? And for me, I can't speak much more for Corinne, but for me, this is a kind of an extension of my experience in the queer community, where my lived experience is different from, you know, my parents as straight people, but also with other people in the queer community. Like, we don't share the same type of queerness, let's say. You know, I'm a cis man, for example, and I feel a kindred spirit with a lot of trans people, like the playwright, and we both feel queer kinship, but their lived experience is something I can't ever quite imagine for myself, but I can attempt at it, and in attempting is how I realize all of my circle of friends and my chosen family and my community is built. And to extend that further to beyond our species, it just feels like an extension of everything I've learned in my queer community. But it can go even further. So trees, I think, are more difficult to empathize with than animals because they don't have faces. But they, I don't know, I feel very connected to trees in general. So it's just a pure passion for me.
I have to agree with that. I love trees as well. And it was kind of funny when I saw that they were aspens, I had that thought to myself of, I don't think we have aspens here, wondering why aspens. And you explained it so beautifully about Corinne's connection to, I guess, the Western part of the States.
But we do have aspens here too.
Oh, we do. Okay. Well, now I've learned something.
We might call them poplar trees here.
Okay. There we go. But now I've learned something, which is that they're a lot more common out west, and that was part of Corinne's inspiration. Yes. I feel tremendous kinship here because I played a tree in an elementary school production once upon a time.
Oh, you did?
So I can say I feel like...
How did you play it?
With a tree, like wearing
what
a trunk.
What were you wearing?
I was like wearing a trunk.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah,
if you can. Did you move your arms at all, or mm-hmm. in the wind?
There were three of us
you
on
did?
Stage. Oh. Yeah, I think if I'm remembering correctly.
Well, we were imagining those children's productions when we were trying to stage this, and being like, okay, what else can we do?
Yeah, like it has that kind of creativity, that kind of fun or sats element that you would imagine in a kindergarten or grade one play where, you know, the kids can be anything because there's so many of them. We have mm-hmm. to make them do something. Only here you're
exactly.
working with six performers on stage, another interesting element, all multi-generational, and they're all kind of being put mm-hmm. into these, you're shaping them into these very different kinds of characters than what you would normally see on stage.
Yeah, the background characters become the foreground characters, and we're approaching the choreography and the staging and the costumes less to like look realistically like a tree or a rock, but more to bring out different elements, like how they feel time, or how they feel connected to each other, or how they feel their weight, and how they feel what does water do to them. All these different aspects inform how they move, rather than it should look like a tree, it should look like a rock.
And you can see an image of two of the performers on our Instagram page, Upstage CKUT. Neat. Thank you so much for coming on the show to tell us about Because of the Mud. I hope you can come back again sometime in the future.
Me too. Thank you so much.
Okay. That was Nate Yaffe, who is the director and choreographer of Because of the Mud and a co-creator. And like I said, that image is up on Upstage CKUT. You can also follow Nate on Instagram as well. He referenced clown work, and I think that is something that Nate also does personally as being an influence in the show. So you can follow Nate Yaffe on Instagram, NateYaffe. And if you would like to see the show itself and get a taste for it personally, you can head over to lachapelle.org for tickets and more information. You can head to billetterie@lachapelle.org to contact the box office or call 514-843-7738. Because of the Mud is February 19th to the 22nd at 7:30. It's in English and there are French surtitles. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM. We're going to listen to a little bit of Alison Russell here. Grew up in Montreal. I think went to school down the street, and she won a Grammy 2 weeks ago, which is kind of cool, and I've been grooving to a lot of her music, including her latest album, which is called The Returner, out last year. When we come back, we're going to find out about two shows. One, a rock opera that has been rocking Montreal audiences for a decade. The other, a relatively much younger piece, but it spans a man's whole lifetime, called Nine Lives and Eight Near Misses. We'll find out more from the two creators in studio in just a moment.
Present tense. Springtime of my present tense.
Thursday, February 15th at 7 p.m., Arc MTL and L'Afro Musée present St. Antoine Street Paradise, an evening with soul legend Skipper Dean. Join legendary Montreal soul and R&B singer Skipper Dean for a journey through the nightclubs around St. Antoine Street and downtown in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. This free event for Black History Month happens on Thursday, February 15th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Afro Musée, 533 Ontario Street East, corner Berry. Find out more about this new collaboration between Arc MTL and the Afro Musée on the website knightsofmontreal.com. A CKUT co-presentation.
Tu t'es occupé de ton ami qui saignait du nez après qu'il soit rentré dans une porte patio fermée, sans rire de lui?
Évidemment.
Avec ton empathie, tu as de l'avenir en santé et services sociaux. Trouve ta place sur québec.ca/carrière en santé. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Black Theater Workshop presents the world premiere of Diggers by Donna Michelle St. Bernard. Abdul and Solomon introduce newbie Bai to the intricacies and dignity of grave digging. But when illness hits their town, they must make the best of a bad situation. Full of song, laughter, tears, and beautiful humanity, Diggers is a tribute to essential workers. Catch Diggers at the Siegel Center Studio from February 1st to the 17th. Get your tickets at siegelcenter.org or call 514-739-7944. More information at blacktheaterworkshop.ca. This is a Black Theater Workshop and Prairie Theater Exchange co-production and CKUT co-presentation.
Yeah. Wonderful music, sounds of Alison Russell, her song Springtime from her album The Returner, now a Grammy winner and also originally from Montreal and I think went to FACE, which is pretty cool. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM. I'm your host, Sarah De A. Our final conversation for the evening will be with two performers who have joined us in studio. And the reason we are speaking to our two guests is because they're both going to be part of what they're calling, I guess, Encore Presents, Getting Time and Space over at Mainline Theater, things that you probably heard a lot of buzz about but haven't been able to see in the last little while. Xander, you've seen one of these shows, so I'm happy that you're here to help me with this interview in particular. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce Jimmy Karamanis, who is a director, writer, and one of the performers of Johnny Legdick, which is celebrating 10 years of rocking Montreal audiences with lewd, insane hero journey that is Johnny Legdick. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
And as well, I'm just going to make sure I got your mic up. I don't think I did there, Jimmy.
Oh.
There you are.
Am I on?
I think so.
Hello.
Can we hear Jimmy? Almost. Okay. In the meantime, I'm also going to welcome to the studio Paul Schenker de Touré, who is the writer and performer of the true story storytelling show Nine Lives and Eight Near Misses, Life Lessons from Near-Death Events, premiered at the Fringe this summer over in the freestanding space. It was an entrancing storytelling show, and I'm so glad that you're back for people who didn't see it the first time around. Welcome to Upstage.
Thank you. It's great to be here. I'm glad to be back as well.
I was trying to think of the things that unified these two shows, and I kind of realized I really don't think there is a unifying factor, except I got a message from Amy over at Mainline to say, these two guys are coming in. Would you like to have them in? And I did find the commonality, which is that they're both very, very entertaining in different levels. Xander's here as well, who has questions, but I'm going to start off by just wanting to get the origin story of Johnny Legdick, because I remember reading about this in the Montreal Gazette so many years ago, and being like, wait, what? It's a story about a guy who has his appendage, if I can say, is not what you would typically expect. It's a hand instead. And he's kind of sold to a circus and has to fight his way for everything in life. Jimmy, where did this character come from?
Just before I say anything, I'm allowed to say Dick, right? Because
yeah,
okay, good.
It comes in an artistic context, so if there are little ears or sensitive ears listening, that word will be said. But okay. It is in the title, so
yeah,
we get dispensation.
So the show originally came from Jonah, who is now playing Johnny in the show, has been since last year, and he just had this like little song that he used to sing in high school, and one day he came up to me at Dawson, so like 11 years ago or so, and started singing it. And, well, we just got kind of, I was doing other shows at the time. I was doing my own like theater stuff, and he came over, brought a bottle of wine, and we just like joked about making this Johnny Legdick thing into a show, just this one song that he had been singing forever. And within like 6 months, it was on.
Okay, so people joke all the time, like en passant, you know, we should turn that into a podcast. We should make the movie about that. Let's make a musical. These little like seeds don't really get planted. They don't really grow. Well, why did Johnny Legdick actually turn in from a song in some guy's head to a full-fledged stage musical that is being performed 10 years later?
To speak to that thing that you just said, that so many ideas go like unmade, I think we're all like pretty familiar with that. I can't 100% say why this one like saw the light of day, other than that we just were laughing like the whole time that we were talking about it. We're like, this is going to be the dumbest show. No one's ever going to see it. It has to be made. It was just like this very silly thing that we just felt compelled to make.
And then to your surprise, you started having sold out audiences.
Yeah.
You ended up recording some of the music. So How does that feel to look back on this improbable dream becoming reality, but also reality that people liked?
It's still not quite believable, if I'm being honest. Like yesterday, we're doing dress rehearsal for the umpteenth time, and I'm here giving like serious directing notes about Legdicks and like, you know, pantsless centaurs and stuff. And it's just zany and fun. And I think it's a good show to just like de-stress with, you know?
De-stress, indeed. Yeah. That is the voice of Jimmy Karamanis. So Johnny Legdick, a rock opera, is going to be performed three times this weekend. Once tomorrow night at 9 o'clock, and then 8 and 10 o'clock on Saturday evening. Yep. We also have with us Paul Shankar, who is responsible for 9 Lives and 8 Near Misses. So when did you start getting into storytelling? You seem like someone who just naturally, wherever you go, you know, is telling stories. But how did you get on stage?
Well, it's true. I do love the sound of my own voice. And
it's a great voice.
Thank you. I had a roommate years ago, and within a week of moving into his place, he kind of walked up to me one day. He's like, so you talk to yourself. I'm like, do I? He's like, all the time, you know? And I'm not talking to myself like a crazy person. I'm usually like, you know, addressing, you know, the Nobel Prize winning committee or the Academy Awards.
Yeah. I'd like to thank, you know, so-and-so.
It's important stuff. Yeah. But I hadn't noticed that. I just think out loud all the time. And it was really funny. Last year, the show went really well. And I kept hearing people say things like, you know, master storyteller. And I'm like, people would ask, well, how long have you been storytelling? I'm like, since April.
Okay. I don't believe you. Really?
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
Before June, that, I just wrote. You're performing to audiences, and you had just started in April.
I went on stage at Confabulation in April. That was kind of my proof of concept. I'm like, let's see if I can deliver it to the level of my preparation. And I did. Let's see if people like it. And they did. I'm like, great, because I already booked the venue. and I mean, I have a lot of teaching experience. I'm not really flustered in front of a crowd. But before this, like, I've been involved with The Fringe for decades. I'm a huge fan. I've been audience member, patron, volunteer, artist. But I was always a playwright. I was like, I'm going to write this show, and then I'm going to find some other flunkies, I mean, actors, to do all the work. And I'm just going to hang back. But this was a show. This was the first time I wrote autobiography, things based from my own life. And I'm like, obviously, I'm going to have to tell these stories. And it was a crazy experience. It came together really fast. One of the great things about The Fringe is that you can do things really fast. Like, from start to finish, it was 6 months. Mm. I started writing it last January, and I was on stage in June.
Yeah, there's people who are signing up for the lottery, and they're going to be putting on a show in just a matter of months. It's extraordinary to think about. Mm-hmm. And I think here that's another link between your two shows that are both so different, is that we talk about speeding up the creative process and actually getting to making something. Mm-hmm. To take a song in someone's head, or like, hey, you do tell stories, and like a couple months later, here you are in front of a paying audience, right?
Yeah, there's a great story that Daniel Brooks, who passed away recently, was theater luminary, worked with Danny McIver for a long time, and he used to say that, you know, young theater artists would always come up to him and say, you know, oh, Mr. Brooks, what should I do to, like, you know, advance my career and move forward and, you know, make art? And he's like, book a venue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And definitely. It's that, right? Like, what does it take to make a show? Like, I think Leonard Bernstein said the same thing. He said, talent and not enough time.
Right.
And we've been talking at Mainline the last couple of days, Jimmy and I, just passing as we're both working on our show, and it's like, nothing motivates like an impending deadline.
Yeah.
And Jimmy, for you hearing this, this is a show that you obviously took a lot of work to get in front of an audience, but now, or maybe not, you kind of looked like
maybe you didn't.
But, you know, even if you've been performing it for 10 years, obviously there's been cast changes, there's different people coming in, you make adjustments. Mm-hmm. You just talked about being in rehearsal a couple of days ago. Like, does that kind of impending sense of we have a date, does
100%.
That help in a group project like an original musical still apply?
110%. I mean, when I left Austin, that was the first thing I did. Like, that summer, I was like, let's book a venue and write and put on a show. And I learned it, like, infinitely more in those 2 months than I had in like the 3 years of prepping for it. Cause it's one thing to say like the world will be like this, and another for you to like experience it firsthand, you know, and make it happen, especially in theater, which is so like DIY and, you know, there are like no handouts. So you really gotta go for it. Yeah.
Yeah, that there's this really interesting duality, actually. Sarah, you were mentioning that there's, you know, there's not much connective tissue between the two shows, but I feel like in terms of their writing process, because I know, Paul, this is a very personal show to you.
And, yeah.
You know, like this, you can tell by listening to it, being a part of the audience. I'm not gonna really give away much of it, because really experiencing it raw is perfect. But, you know, you can tell that it came from a singular source, and Legdick was very much a collective experience, right? So I'm very curious to talk about, you know, did it feel lonely at all to write to put so many of these personal stories on there on your own? Did you have like somebody to work with as a sounding board, so to speak? And Jimmy, like, what was it like to share a page, to work with so many people, you know, putting so many words down?
You wanna go first, Paul?
Yeah, sure. Well, it's actually related to the idea of like book a venue, have a deadline. And this was a one person show, and I really designed it knowing I had very little resources. I wanted to be able to do a show where I literally walk in off the street like the audience, walk onto stage, put my bag down, turn, start talking. Mm-hmm. There's no sound cues, there's no light cues, there's no set, there's nothing. And that being said, if there's one thing that I learned more than anything else doing this process, it's just I wish I could just murder the myth of the solitary artist. Like, I wrote and performed a show all by myself, and there was an army of amazing people helping me the whole way. And if I hadn't been accountable to them, you know, either as a group or individually every step of the way, yeah, I wouldn't have done it. Mm-hmm. You know, I started doing it because my fringe friend TJ Daw, who's like a writer-performer of some repute, he was offering an online workshop last January. And he's like, oh, hey, you know what? Paul, there's a few spots left if you're interested. And I'm like, I'm like, $550? I don't have that kind of money. And then I was like, you know what? If I was ever going to pay money to like take a show, a workshop called Intro to Solo Show Creation, it would be with the TJ Daw.
Yeah.
And I...
Your friend.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, he'll really know him. He knows everybody.
But also just, very talented. Yeah.
You know, we just know him through the decades of French performance. And it was my Christmas present to myself. I took the class. It was like, I think, 4 weeks. You know, 3 hours twice a week. And within the first class, I was like, this was a huge, huge, hugely good idea. Because again, I was surrounded by...
Why was it good for you?
Well, he's an amazing... He's not just a great writer-performer. He's a scholar of the form. And his class is fantastic. But it's also being surrounded by a bunch of other people mm-hmm. who are there and have all the same doubts as you, you know? And you realize, oh, I'm not unique with all my tortured process and my back of my hand stapled to my forehead. Like, we all go through this, and it's normal. I think most people work at the last minute. Most people need someone else to be accountable to, and that's what it was for me, you know. And this comes out of my biology background as well. I was just studying humans more as a group than as individuals. Like, we're not individuals, we're clans, we're families, we're in relationship with everyone else. And this idea of like being these atomized, splintered people, I think it's actually pretty hurtful. I think there's a lot more loneliness in the mm-hmm. world because of that idea, because we're not really investing in habitual relationships the way we did, you know, in some mystical primitive time.
And was there a kind of an aha moment that kind of got you on this sort of this path to this need to push against this idea of the solitary artist and the inherent like auteur mythos behind it?
I think so, and I don't know, you know, Jimmy, you wrote it and directed it, but there's a whole group around you. But I think you know, we're often much kinder with our friends than we are with ourselves. You know, we often, the kind of self-talk we have in our own heads, man, we would never tolerate one of our friends talking to us that way. And that really puzzled me. I'm like, why am I so much more willing to get up off the couch and do something difficult because a friend needs help than I would be for myself? Like, shouldn't I love myself as much as I love my friends? Mm. And why is that? And a lot of it is just, there's a million reasons. I think some of the stuff that I was exploring in the show is that I kind of looked at some of the lessons I had absorbed very young about what it is to be a man, like a cishet man in the patriarchy. And it's not, people talk about it now, but no one was talking about it when I was a kid. So you just absorb these things. You know, I had a math teacher once who said, whoever discovered water, it certainly wasn't a fish, right? Like, what's all around you is hard to notice. And if it's something that's pernicious and damaging, well, it's going to damage you without noticing. So I made a show, and I knew that if I said, I'd like to talk about the importance of community and emotional vulnerability, I would sell zero tickets, right?
Well, I wanted to know, because I'm sure this came up in your your class, the idea of packaging your story and what's the through line and what is it that you're trying to bring to people? Because, yeah, you can't be like a seminar on my thoughts on this topic. You frame this as 9 lives, 8 near misses, like times where your life was in danger. And it is a bit of a roller coaster. Why did you choose to, like, for instance, just as an example, there's a car crash when you're really, really young. You're talking about a lot of family things that are mishaps. Yeah,
there's a car crash full of kids, you know, yeah. Like I was one of the kids. Spoiler alert. I made it, right?
Yeah. Thank goodness.
And there's an encounter with a knife-wielding madman. Yeah. And then there's stories that are a little bit more... Sometimes the near death is more like emotional than it is physical. Mm-hmm. Like I tell a story about the best birthday present ever and the worst Christmas present ever. And I think it's funny. I talked about this, and I would just talk about it in conversation with friends after. And you'd be amazed if you sit down and ask people. Almost everyone has had some experience that qualifies as, that's the day I almost died. Mm. Mm. And we don't often think about it, but when you do, you're like, oh, that car accident could have died. And so many people have like almost drowned, or yeah, I was a little too close to the edge of that cliff. And those brushes with death, we all kind of have them, but we often don't think about why they happened or how they could help us, you know, grow.
Was the idea to be relatable, or was it to kind of grab people's attention? 9 lives, 8 near misses.
Oh my goodness. So I love The Fringe, but like, and Jimmy, you can attest to this. Come on, it's 10 days, it's 500 showings. Like even the most avid Fringe goer is going to miss shows they want to see. Mm-hmm. And there's every year, there's many, many amazing artists who have made beautiful things that slip through the cracks. So you have to sell yourself. And it's kind of funny. I talk about the sidewalk pitch and the elevator pitch. You know, you have like 5-10 seconds when you meet people and you're hustling at Fringe Park. And it took me to like the final weekend to get my pitch down. And it had nothing to do with my show. And I'll tell it to you right now. It's like, hey, you should come see my show. It's 9 lives, 8 near misses. Life lessons from near-death events. It's true stories about my life. You should come. It'll make your life better. And if it doesn't,
it's pretty good.
There's a money-back guarantee.
Yeah, there is the money-back guarantee. That kind of works. Does that sell you, Jimmy, as a theater goer?
Does it sell me? Sorry?
Yeah. Does that sell you?
Would
you
absolutely. I'm going to see it on Saturday.
I'm going to see it tomorrow. So I'm seeing Johnny Legdick, rock opera. Don't miss it.
Yeah.
I'll be there.
That's a good one, too.
I want to do one more crossover thing before we wrap up the conversation. So we've got a one-man storytelling show. We've got a rock opera that is kind of filthy and a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. Jimmy, do you ever see yourself doing a one-man show that is storytelling-based?
That's so funny that you say that. So funnily enough, I'm doing Legdick now. Again, and you were asking about the collaborative process before, and I didn't write it solo. I wrote it with the other band members, including all the music. Like, we all did it together. But when I did Legdick originally, we're talking like in 2014, after it, I was like, I want to try my shot at a one-man show. So very few people know this, but I actually did do a one-man show in The Fringe in like 2015, I think. And I never talk about it because it bombed so hard, you know?
Oh.
It was supposed to be a show about anxiety, but like I could not get the script down even up to the day. Like I just could not come up with a script. So I kind of like improvised it a little bit with some music. I thought it would add like, this is what anxiety is like talking in front of an audience. Some people liked it, but I never talk about it, and you will never hear about it after this.
This is the last bit. Okay.
Yeah.
Very interesting insight there.
Yeah.
Paul, for yourself, would you ever join a lewd musical, rock opera?
In a second.
Okay.
In a hot second. No
problem.
I
think there's some potential for cross-pollination here that I'm very excited. Xander, did you have any last thoughts or questions?
I mean, I have so many, but we've got like 3 minutes left here. But really, like, I would like to double back because we never actually got back to answering, your answer to that question, right? Like, what was it like to just have a communal spirit with just getting the script down?
I've always done that, except for the one-man show that didn't exist. I've always... gotten like in a writer's room. I find it really gets the best out of everyone's abilities, and then you don't have that like solo artist sort of like rock on your back that Paul was describing. So I think you get the most out of, especially like a kind of comedic thing, by getting as many people to laugh as possible. So I mean, I obviously could not have done it with anyone else except the 5 guys that I did it with. So shout out to them.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Thank you both so much for coming in to tell us about the two shows. We can follow you both on Instagram, at Post It Paul, for you, Paul
That's
Shankar.
Right. Post It Paul.
De Torre, did I say your name right?
You did. Great. Perfect. Every time.
And at Jimmy Karamanis on Instagram as well. And Johnny Lectic has his own page, the musical it does, itself. Yeah. So you guys are supporting each other through the weekend. You have shows this weekend and next, Paul. And you will be performing three times this weekend with Johnny Lectic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
Awesome. Okay, so tickets and more information, head to mainlinetheater.ca or visit their online ticketing site to pick up yours. And I'm sure they're going fast. Are we hearing about sellouts yet?
Tomorrow night, there's like 20 tickets left for tomorrow, about 30 left for Saturday.
Nice.
So. Okay, so rush to get those. We're going to close out the show with a little bit of Hannah High Five, which is one of my favorite sure. songs. If you want to preview Johnny Lectic, you can head to the Bandcamp page as well. You said this was recorded a couple of years ago.
Oh, yeah. But In fact, none of the people who sing on that album are still in the cast.
But good to know. But the music is still pretty spot on, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, fabulous. Thank you both so much for coming in, Jimmy and Paul. Thank you, Xander, for being here this evening.
Always happy to be here.
And a very big thank you to our other guests as well. Nate Yaffe, whose show Because of the Mud is at La Chapelle next week. Nai Shi Wang and Jean Abreu, who are performing at the Mai this weekend in Deciphers. You've been listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca. Thanks to Jack Solar, our spoken word coordinator. Follow us on Instagram at Upstage CKUT for our images of our guests and more. I'm your host, Sarah Day. We'll speak with you next Thursday on Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM. Have fun. Stay safe this weekend. Up next is my friend Fortner Anderson on the show Grey Matters. Have a great weekend. Phone number has recently changed. You can now reach us at 438-858-6116. We would like to thank Fed Phone Line for providing us with this number for free. They wanted us to tell you that they help save money to inmates, family, and friends by reducing the cost of collect calls. For more information about their company, you can go to fedphoneline.com. So again, our new number is 438-858-6116. You can call us collect from Bordeaux Prison and Riviere de Prairie Prison at that number. As always, we're an all-volunteer collective and don't always manage to answer the phone. If you can leave a message, please do. If you're calling collect and we don't pick up, try again next time you can get to the phone. And again, our phone number is 438-858-6116, and you can call us collect from Riviere de Prairie Prison or Bordeaux Prison.
Stakes of this continued support for Israel, the stakes of continuing to whitewash its crimes, Biden risks passing and paying a very high price for this, and the Democratic Party risks paying a very high price for this, because Muslim Americans, Arab Americans, progressive Americans are increasingly making clear every single day that they will not vote for Biden.
That's Sarah Lee Whitson, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Sarah Lee Whitson.